Thanks so much, Pastor Jordan. 2 Samuel chapter number 1. 2 Samuel chapter number 1. If you're not familiar with what that is, that's okay. 2 Samuel is in the Old Testament. If you start in the very front, Genesis, you're going to find Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Keep going. You're going to find Joshua, Judges, and then you'll come across Samuel. If you hit Kings or Chronicles, you've gone too far. Or just Google 2 Samuel chapter number 1. 2 Samuel chapter number 1. As we begin a series tonight out of this book, talking about God's grace in our weakness. God's grace in our weakness. Of course, you know, if you've been around Faith Baptist for a little bit, we've already gone through 1 Samuel, and we talked about who will be your king. That was the whole idea. Was the nation of Israel individually and collectively going to submit to the rule of God in their life, or are they going to want to be their own king and have a manifestation of that through an earthly king? And we know, sadly, the story, right, that they said no to God's rule through the judges, and they demanded and wanted a king like every other nation. So we read the fateful tales of the reign of Saul, and saw his rejection and the anointing of David. We are just on the cusp of seeing what God's going to do through life and work of David. So 2 Samuel is where we are at tonight. We're going to go through chapter 1, 2 Samuel chapter 1. I want us to read it, and then we're going to go through the message tonight speaking about the change of forgiveness, the change of forgiveness. I want you to look at verse 1 with me, if you would, 2 Samuel chapter 1. Now it came to pass, after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, it came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was, when he came to David, that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, from whence comest thou? And he said unto him, out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. David said unto him, how went the matter, knowing that there had been a war taking place there? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered, that the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David said unto the young man that told him, how knowest that thou that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead? And the young man said unto him, as I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called unto me, and I answered, here am I. And he said unto me, who art thou? And I said, I'm an Amalekite. He said unto me again, stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay thee, for anguish is come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head, and the bracelet that was upon his arm, and have brought them hither unto my lord. Then David took hold of his clothes, and rent them, and likewise all the people that were with him. And I want you to catch this in verse 12. It's so important. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for who? What does it say there? For who? For Saul. They wept, they mourned, they fasted for Saul, for Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. And David said unto the young man that told him, whence art thou? In other words, where are you from? He answered, I'm the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. And David said unto him, how wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called one of his young men and said, go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, let blood be upon thy head. For thy mouth has testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. David lamented with the lamentation over who again? Saul. Over Saul and over Jonathan his son. And he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Let the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, not lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew
neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain and from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over who? Saul. Weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thy high places. I'm distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? Tonight, as we go through 2 Samuel chapter number 1 and we talk about God's grace through weakness, the title of the message is The Change That Forgiveness Makes. I read the story of the first missionaries who came to Alberta, Canada. And they were opposed by a young chief of the Cree Indians, Maskipton. But eventually, he responded to the message these missionaries brought. And he accepted Jesus as his Savior and said no to his cultural upbringing and his religion and accepted Christ. He became a strong advocate for Protestantism amongst his tribe and other tribes. Shortly after becoming a follower of Christ, a member of the Blackfoot tribe killed his father. So Maskipton rode into the village where the murderer lived. The story goes that he demanded he be brought before him, and he confronted the guilty man and said this, as it's recorded, "You've killed my father, so now you must be my father. You must ride my best horse and wear my best clothes." Now, taken back in utter amazement, his enemy cried with remorse, "My son, now you've killed me." What he went on to explain by that is that the hate he had had towards Maskipton and why he had done what he had done had been vindicated by the actions of forgiveness and graciousness that this Christian Indian chief had towards him. It erased the hate and replaced it with kindness. Tonight, we're going to open 2 Samuel and see a powerful account of forgiveness. Now, at first, it may not strike us as one, right? 2 Samuel 1, like I said this morning, we think of great passages of forgiveness in the Bible. You go a lot of places, but maybe in your mind, you didn't pull up. And then 2 Samuel 1, the lament for Saul. That probably didn't pop into your mind as your first go-to passage on a lesson of forgiveness. But what I want us to recognize is, given what takes place in this passage, with whom it takes place, that I imagine and I highly suspect you're going to arrive at the conclusion that forgiveness is not only the implicit message of the passage, but that forgiveness is possible for each of us. And not only is it possible for each of us, it is powerful for each one of us. 2 Samuel is the opening in our English Bible. That's really just the continued narrative in the Hebrew Bible, the book of Samuel. And just to give us a quick reminder and recap for those maybe who aren't familiar with what happened in 1 Samuel. Remember, the nation rejects the rule of God. They want a king. They want a king just like the other nations who they can look to and trust and follow. And while Samuel tries to dissuade them as the prophet of God, they will not be dissuaded. And so God gives them a king after their own heart. Remember Saul, he's tall, he's good looking, he's who they want, he's head and shoulders above all of them, he's going to be their leader in battle, he's going to be the face for the nation of Israel. Finally, they'll be established amongst all the other nations, and people will know Israel by their king, Saul. While that was true outwardly, sadly, he mirrored their idolatrous hearts coming out of the times of the judges inwardly. And so we would catalog through chapters 8 on how Saul struggled in fearfulness, in egotism, in anger, and indulgence. Instead of seeing allies, all he could see were enemies. When God brought his son and then this other who became a son like unto a son to him, David, into his life, he ended up hating them and distrusting them both. And so ultimately, because he would not bow to obedience to the Lord, and he continued to do what he desired for his own ego, and he would not do that which God called him and commanded to, but continued to practice in the way he wanted to practice, God dethroned him. He was no longer the Lord's anointed, and David was anointed in his stead, a man after his heart. Now, it's the total opposite. He doesn't look like Saul. He doesn't have the bravado necessarily of Saul, but God uses his teachable and tender, imperfect heart to become the next king of Israel. There's one problem, one catch, right? Saul was not having it. Saul would not leave the throne that God said he was kicked off of. And so that begins the story, really, that we find in Samuel. David on the run for 20 years from Saul, unwilling to give up the throne over and over and over again. David going in and out of caves, in and out of enemy territory. Always on the run, going here, going there, trying to find just anything he could to be safe, secure, and have food for himself. And then as people join his band, trying to find safety and security there. And if they could find it in Israel, they did. If they couldn't, they had to go to enemy territory. And you find David in this constant state of panic, or maybe we'd call it insecurity, or we'd call it an apprehensiveness, whatever word you want to put there. He had just wave after wave of this because of the uncertainty of his situation. That brings us to our current passage. David is set up in Ziklag, which you can see on the map here on the screen, in the southern portion of the nation, in Philistine territory. And he has defeated the Amalekites who raided their town, Ziklag. And he's come back, and they're there. But while they are there, Saul is fighting the Philistines in the north area there, as you see at the top of the mountain map, in Mount Gilboa is where the slaughter takes place. And so we have two battles taking place. David victorious over the Amalekites, Saul falling to the Philistines there in King Achish. And that's where 2 Samuel introduces us. This war, or this skirmish, this battle, I should say, has just ended. Saul is dead. David is back at Ziklag. And that's what we read. So news of King Saul and Jonathan's death reveals David's heart of forgiveness based upon the reaction and response. And there's a desire I would have tonight for us to walk away with this passage from and go back when we're struggling and held back to what can forgiveness do? Is it possible? It'd be this passage and this thought. Forgiveness transforms our motives and our choices towards an enemy by valuing God's work through them, God's work for them, and God's work for us. That's the power of forgiveness. That's the change forgiveness can make. It transforms our motives and our choices towards somebody we would consider our enemy. So when we think about the change forgiveness makes, first thought this morning or this evening, whichever it is, from verses 1 through 16 is this. It changes the way we interpret bad news befalling those who have hurt us. It changes the way we interpret bad news befalling someone who has hurt us. What's taken place? David has returned home, as we said. And in verse 2, a haggard-looking man comes into his camp. He has the appearance of being in mourning or being sad because he has rent his clothes. He has dirt on his head. Those were symbols in their culture of great mourning. Something bad has befallen someone if you're in that state. So he comes to David, he comes into the camp, and he's ushered before King David, and he comes and he bows himself before him, and he has news of the battle that's been taking place. Now, David knows both parties involved. Remember, David had spent time in the presence of King Achish in Philistia, but he also had spent time in the presence of Saul, and he knows those two are duking it out up there around Mount Gilboa. So in verses 3 and 4, David inquires about where he's coming from, and the man indicates he's been in the camp there that was previously occupied by the reigning king, Saul. And so David wants to know, how's he doing? How did it end up? The man informs him of bad news. And what is it? Thousands are dead. Israel has been devastated by the Philistines and King Achish as their leader. And if it couldn't get much worse, here's the worst part. Not only has Jonathan, the prince, died, but Saul, the king of Israel, is dead as well. Now, we read it in verse 5. This news seems to grip David's attention, and so he demands to know how this man is aware of such tragic news. It's so tragic that the king wants to vet this stranger's credibility. He's like, okay, I heard that. How can you know that? How can you tell me that that's true? Why should I believe you that Israel's been decimated and the king and the prince are dead? So in verses 6 through 10, this man gives a story. Now, is it historically what did happen compared to the passage we had in 1 Samuel? Is it a concocted story he has created or manufactured and is now feeding the king? We don't know, maybe to a certainty. But the man tells the story like this in verse 6. He just happened to be in the area. And while he was there in the area, he sees King Saul. And he does a good job of giving enough details to be believable because he says, I saw the man there with his spear. And we know King Saul and his spear were typically inseparable unless it's being chucked at David. And he's there and he's fleeing and he's injured. And in this story, he says, the king beckons me to come to him. He allows an enemy of Israel, an Amalekite, to come over to him. And he discusses his injuries, and he wants to die by the hand of this enemy of Israel. And so the Amalekite implies that he killed the king that moment as an act of compassion, knowing this, that Saul was injured, and so I did the humane thing when he asked me to end his life. He was going to die anyway. I made it quick so there was no suffering. So I ended the life of King Saul to show conclusively to anybody who may want proof, okay, that's quite the story. What do you have for verification? He says, so I lifted the crown off his hand. I took the armband that would have signified not only his position but also his standing in Israel and the tribe he's from, and I brought you these items. So David learns of Saul's death from this Amalekite drifter who's bragging about delivering the death blow to Israel's king and produces, again, this evidence to support his claim. Now, it seems, given the way he presents the story and what he does towards David and what he has to show David as trophies, it seems, and historically, it seems Christendom has interpreted it as such, that he's under the impression that not only will David rejoice that he killed Saul, but that he will also reward him for his act as it benefited David to now be able to have a clear path to be the established king of Israel. But verse 11 and 12, that's not what we read, is it? Look at verse 11 again. That news has come to him. The evidence is there. Then David took hold of the man, kissed him on both sides of his face, and gave him a blank check. That's not what it says, is it? David rips his clothes, and likewise everybody else. And so they have the symbolism of mourning, and then they produce the fruit of mourning. He doesn't delight in the news of Saul or Jonathan. Though Saul was his rival, Saul was his merciless persecutor, he was still in David's mind, and as he showed over and over again in his life, the Lord's anointed. How many times did David have the opportunity to end Saul's life? Many. And would he? No. Even the one time he wanted to know just how close he got, he had just a little bit of his garb off there, he was still smitten in his heart that he had even done something that way to try to stick it to the Lord's anointed. So in David's heart, he's not like, yes, finally, I knew this day was going to come. That's not it at all. Saul's dead. The proof's in front of him. And David sees this as a national tragedy. How deeply did it affect him and his loyal men? This is important, his loyal men. I like the way one author said it. He said it like this. The narrator goes out of his way to emphasize the depth of David's grief by heaping up verbs that show or demonstrate his lamentation. This is the only place in the Old Testament where all three of these are coupled together. And what is it? They mourn all day. They fast all day. They weep. They ruined their apparel. That may not seem like much to us because we have so many changes of garments, but that wasn't the case in their time. So they are devastated by the tragic news, and I want you to catch the narrator's very clear. It's not, well, we're sad for the nation of Israel and the many thousands of men lost that day, or we're sad exclusively for my friend Jonathan, who was always such a supporter. Over and over, the focus is on who? Saul. Yes, Jonathan. Yes, the nation of Israel, but Saul. This is a tragic day. He is mourning. He is grieving. They deny themselves all day. At some point, we're not sure when, in verse 13 and 14, the newly cemented king asks the wanderer, where are you from? He wants to know, okay, you have this story and you have these items. Who are you? Where are you from? I don't know you. You wandered in and told me this, and I'm grieving here because I accept it as true because I recognize the items. You couldn't have gotten them otherwise. Tell me who you are and where you're from. So the man explains, well, I'm the son of a stranger. If we had time, we could look back at Leviticus chapter number 19. You can put that in your notes later and see that that detailed some of the immigration laws that Israel had as the covenant people surrounding the people that surrounded them. And so he says, well, I'm the son of a stranger. In other words, my dad lived as a proselytized individual in the land. Maybe he was a follower or not, but at the end of the day, he was allowed to live in the area, and he grew up in the nation of Israel. Now, this is where, to me, the story shows just how serious this is in David's life, in his heart. He asks him what seems like a benign question, doesn't it? Where are you from? The guy says, Israel. I grew up there. Somebody look at this. Look at his response in verse number, what, 13 or 14? Yeah, he asked him there in verse 13. Look at 14. And David said unto him, how is thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? To the simple response of, yeah, I grew up in Israel, David has what I would call almost a volcanic response. You mean you grew up in Israel? You know who Saul was? It's unthinkable and inexcusable that you found it appropriate, even bragworthy, that you would take the king's, the Lord's anointed's life. What are you doing? What did you think was going to happen when you do? You thought I'd be happy that that took place? At best, this guy standing in front of King David now is either a grave robber, or at worst, he did indeed strike down the Lord's anointed as he's claiming. Check out David's response in verses 15 and 16. David uses the same language in contrast that Saul had used when he struck down the priest of Nob. And so the author here has given us this contrast. In verse 15, David says, call one of the young men and go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. Remember, when Saul did this, he did it in an unjust manner towards the priests of Nob because they had aided and abetted David on the run. They had done something just, and he responded to their just cause in injustice by having them murdered. He said, strike them down. Now, David says about the man who's claiming to have killed the Lord's anointed, he says, strike that man down. And oh, the irony here. Saul refused to kill the Amalekites at God's command, and if it's true, he was killed by an Amalekite. But here's the one I want you to see. David is not only grieved, he's furious. And he gives his rationale in verse 16. He pronounces the rationale for his judgment after the execution had taken place. And what is it? He was choosing justice. He commands his man to strike down the Amalekite for having murdered the Lord's anointed. Now catch it. David is the rightful king in waiting. He had said no to moving that path earlier when he had the opportunity with Saul. So how in the world did this man think he was going to be rewarded by David for killing Saul when David could have done that a long time ago? And he didn't, because he was the Lord's anointed. So verse 17 and 18, David composes a lament for Saul and Jonathan. And I want you to catch the significance of this event in David's heart and life. Look at verse 17 and 18. Look what he says here. And David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son, and he bade them teach the children of Israel to use the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. He requires his countrymen to learn the lament he wrote, and he memorializes it in a book that we suspect, because we don't have it any longer historically, we expect or suspect it was a book that compiled his heroic stories of the Israelite nation, or if you would, their exploits or war songs. Further, this song would accompany military training. There's some debate about the word bow here, if it's just indicating that it was a song or if it actually was in military training. Most tend to think, because of the structure that it's written in, that it was actually the way they would train with these new bows, because the Philistines had the military superiority in that manner, that as they trained these men to learn archery, that one of the things they would do is do that training to the memorialization given in the lament by David about King Saul. So David wants the Israelite people to not forget this. Saul was lost in a battle with Achish. Just put your pause here button here. This should be favorable news. You hear what I'm saying? I mean, the guy who's hunted you for 20 years, the guy who fought God's proclamation about the throne of Israel, that guy's dead. There's no more running, David. There's no more hiding in caves, David. There's no more starving almost, David. There's no more worrying about how to care for your 600-plus people, David. There's no more hurting from what the betrayal and mistrust is doing in your soul, David. I mean, if I could put it this way, someone needs to call Domino's and get a 12-pack of Dr. Pepper. It's time to have a party, right? This is not sad time. This is happy time. But David starkly goes the opposite direction than what we would expect. He's weeping. He's mourning. He's fasting. He's delivering justice. He's even memorializing for his people for generations and generations and generations to come. What? Why are you doing this, David? I would submit to you, it's because forgiveness changes the way we interpret bad news befalling those who have hurt us. There are people that have hurt you, people that have hurt me, and who our heart, at a level, if we were being honest with people at the depths of our heart level, that we would like to see some vindication against. We would like them to experience some level of bad news in their life. But that's not God's heart. I need to, and you need to ask, can I, with a clear conscience, say that I'm sad, maybe even to the point of the spectrum of grieved, for things to go ill in their life rather than I'm delighted by it? That's the power or evidence of forgiveness. Now, if God should chastise, that's his business. He's holy God, not me, not you. But I don't have to long for it by my estimation. You don't need to see it happen immediately in your life the way you perceive. You and I don't have to wait for God to pick up for us as he owes us because of what this person did to us, what this couple did, what that person, what this boss. No. Forgiveness transforms our motives. Forgiveness transforms our choices towards an enemy by valuing God's work through them, for them, and for us. Second thought, the change forgiveness makes is that it changes the way we view how God could have or how God did use them. How God could have or how he did use them. So we don't celebrate when bad things befall them, and we also take time to view differently how God could have or did use them. Look at verse 19 and 20. David's lament that everybody was going to have to learn. How do you like that? Hey, I wrote this song. Learn it. He starts this song off in verse 19 with what? The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen? In verse 19 and 20, David likened Saul and Jonathan to majestic creatures in Israel. The idea here of this creature on the hills is this idea of a majestic buck up there on the rugged hills of Israel. But that buck is now dead, lying in a prominent place. It reflects the tragedy and the reality of Saul's death. The death of Saul and Jonathan, he calls the mighty being fallen. And verses 21, David calls for the nation to remember the tragedy that took place on the Mount of Gilboa. How much so? He says in verse 20, I don't want this being spoken of in Philistine. I don't want them having a cause to celebrate. And they need to be very careful if they decide to celebrate. But then I want you to think about Gilboa, where this took place. I don't want there to be rain there. I don't want there to be crops there. I don't want there to ever be blessing there. I want it to be a cursed land. I want it to be cursed. Why? Because Saul died there. Now, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Saul had not been very kind to David, and David's saying, oh, no, 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 may we never forget King Saul. Not with all these caveats of, may we never forget King Saul, and what a sorry dog he was. Not, let us never forget King Saul. Now, kids, learn the right lessons here. No, no, he's saying, let's not forget what God did in and through the life of Saul, how he used that in our lives, how he blessed us through his reign. This is backwards to how we think, but it's how God's forgiveness changes us. In verses 22 through 24, David recounts the exploits of both Jonathan and Saul and their valiant quests in battle. He speaks of their bond as a dad and a son, but as blessed warriors of the nation. He highlights the prosperity and security the vulnerable women enjoyed because of Saul's reign. Remember what he says? He's like, they were like eagles, they were like lions. And he says, ladies, and in their culture, ladies were not able to care for themselves the way they could. They needed defenders, and God was their protector, and he put people around them on purpose. He says, ladies, I would remind you, the good things you have right now and enjoy, that was because how God used Saul. While the Philistine women were instructed by David not to celebrate Saul's passing, he calls on the women of Israel to mourn because it's a great loss, not only nationally, but they have benefited from the reign of Saul. Verse 25 and 26, he speaks of their death in battle as a costly loss. Again, the mighty have fallen. David closes the lament by honoring the person closest to him in his life. Now, I understand, unfortunately, and I think it's important we do still address it because it's becoming ever more an issue in our culture. David speaks about Jonathan's love as being more or greater than that of women. Now, somebody may say, I had never heard this about this passage, and that's good and that's fine, but I'm just telling you this is a go-to passage for modern Christianity and modern culture trying to show that the Bible endorses an LGBTQ lifestyle, saying that David and Jonathan were in such a relationship. Now, the reason David phrases his love for Jonathan in this manner as more than women is not in an LGBTQ or homosexual manner. It's this. In their time, marriages were not based on choice of the individuals necessarily. They were arranged. And they were usually arranged for some level of benefit, whether it's politically, whether it's financially. But it's very rarely, I really love this person. I want to spend the rest of my life with them. And so a lot of marriages were just that, of convenience. They were that of business transaction. It didn't mean you actually had an important, viable, supportive partner throughout your life. So David here is not saying, I had a passion or a desire for Jonathan in a romantic way. He's saying this, I have never had the support and care and help that I had from anyone else. Not even the relationships I've had with the different women that were, because David had plenty of women in his life, and the women I've had in my life, nobody has come close to the support and care for my life like my friend Jonathan. So he memorializes his support and his care and his kindness and familial love. David doesn't only sing of Jonathan, though. He sings positively of Saul. Pause here. Is this untruthful? Saul had been evil to David.
So is David now misremembering that? It's been 20 years. Does David have the rose-colored glasses on, as we like to say in our culture? Some at this point might greatly disagree with the idea that it's the passage is about forgiveness and how it's changed David. And somebody may say, well, the word forgiveness isn't used, so it must be another motive that factors in here. Perhaps it's not forgiveness at all, Pastor. Perhaps it's just blatant hypocrisy. Blatant hypocrisy by David. He's a fake. He's a liar in this moment. Maybe he's doing it for, I don't know, his poor memory. Maybe he's doing it because of political posturing. If he's going to be the next king, he has to show out here. Well, let's walk through some of those. It seems we can rule out hypocrisy as there are rare times David blatantly lied to trick others. There are some moments like that, but it wasn't his M.O. If anything, the Psalms show us a man who is genuine and raw and transparent. So I don't think we could really make the case for hypocrisy here contextually. It seems we can rule out remembering poorly because all his men also mourned because they held the same passion and heart towards the Lord's anointed that David did. It seems we could rule out political jockeying as the men that David is with, he doesn't have to political jockey with them. They're loyal to him already. That's why they are there. It seems that only forgiveness can stand as a motive for what we witness in this chapter, and I'll say in the future as well, how he treats Saul's descendants. He has no need to do so if he's still bitter and harboring a grudge. So how about it? If that's the change forgiveness could make in David's life after 20 years of mistreatment, who is it then that you and I need to have forgiveness change us about tonight? I'm not talking about misguided ideas of who or what that has somehow offended you based on your emotions, you got your feelings hurt, or because of some unbiblical expectation I held or that you held. These aren't issues of forgiveness towards the other party. That's a need of maturity on my end or your end. So we're not talking about that. What I'm talking about, forgiveness changing us in and about, is this. Something happened. Someone did something. Someone made a decision. Somebody acted or reacted in a way that was biblically wrong. And it remains unsettled. Has the power of forgiveness changed you about that person? Has it changed me about that person? What concerns me is that too often we confuse forgiveness and we say I can't or I won't because we mistake it with condoning. Now hear me out for a second. We mistake I can't or won't forgive because we have conflated and mixed it and said if I do, it's condoning. We think forgiveness means that if we do not forgive, or if we forgive, then therefore we are at odds with or don't believe in justice. We think that if we choose to forgive, then it's as if we're saying that what happened was okay, or that I'm wrong for knowing what I do about the situation or feel about the situation. And it's as if we're saying if I forgive, then I'm denying the struggles that are in my heart due to the wrongdoing, the hurt, and offense. And if I just can't forgive because then they get away with it. Then it's like I'm saying it was okay and never happened. Can I help us tonight by saying that's a false dichotomy? You can forgive while at the same time agreeing that justice still needs to happen. You can forgive and still know God can and will do his work in the situation. And if it never gets resolved the way you wished it were, it never gets closure, that you can still be changed by the power of forgiveness. My wife recently was watching a Dateline. Again, pray for me, and if I go missing, look at her. This was tragic. This devout, professed, they documented it, Christian couple's daughter disappeared. It was a cold case for decades. And finally, they found the body, and the cold case was cracked wide open, and they were able to figure out who had killed their daughter. It ends up it was somebody close to them, somebody they knew, who also was religious, even claiming to be a Christian, though he had a lot of issues in his life taking place. What was tragic about the story, besides the loss of life of the young lady, was this. The closing last 2 minutes of the Dateline went like this. The host asked them this. Since you are Christians, have you forgiven the man who killed your daughter? The dad instantly said, yes. We can forgive him, but we can't forgive what he did. They turned to the mom. She said, no. He said, but you're a Christian. Aren't you supposed to forgive him? If you have faith that says that, shouldn't you forgive him? And she said, no. I can't forgive him. He shot our daughter. Other Christians say I should forgive him, but how can you forgive evil? And that's how they close the episode. Well, I'm not trying to diminish their anguish, okay? Please don't get me wrong here. There could be no more of an anti-gospel message than that. How can I forgive when there's been evil perpetrated? We're saved because God will forgive evil and still be just, because they are not at odds with each other. You can forgive, and there can still be justice. Also, my friends, I want to be clear. Forgiveness does not mean that we don't struggle. It's normal, it's human, it's natural that when there is a lack of justice, when there is a lack of closure, when there is a lack of reconciliation, there can still be apprehension. There can still be anxiety. There can still be anger. There can still be sadness. There can still be confusion in your thoughts about the scenario and the person, about the times you may have to run into them, the places you may see them may bring these and stoke these in your heart, the moments you have to interact. You may say, well, I still struggle in my feelings, in my thoughts, Pastor. I'm not saying that that's bizarre. That's normal. You're human. But those are the moments for God's grace to accomplish what? His peace, his love, his outlook through you, even if the other person won't. Even if they won't, the power of forgiveness can change you. Struggles included, we need to ask ourselves, is forgiveness changing us? I'm going to say a few things, and it's not always pleasant when we hear them. Does that mean your ex-wife, the power of forgiveness can change you about her? Does that mean your ex-husband, that the power of forgiveness can change you about him? Well, Pastor, you're not talking about my coworker, are you? Yeah, I am. Yeah. Are we talking about my parent or guardian that mistreated me, abandoned me, or did wrong to me? We're not saying it's right in justice. We're saying the power of forgiveness changes us, where we don't have to want, wish, and desire ill to befall them, and we can actually learn to thank God for what he did in and through them and how he used that in our lives. We're talking about my kids' grandparents who did us wrong. There can be forgiveness there. Doesn't make it right, but there can be forgiveness. We're talking about an adult child? Yes. Are we talking about a pastor? Somebody just help me out there. Thank you. Yes. We're talking about that deacon, that Sunday school teacher, that church member. How many people are missing out on what God has commanded and called them to have and enjoy in the local church because they won't forgive someone from a church in the past? Forgiveness is not condoning. Forgiveness doesn't mean you don't struggle, but forgiveness means I'll be changed by God's help and by God's power. Well, surely you're not talking about that once cherished friend who did me the worst in my life. We are. What are we seeing? Already in the book of 2 Samuel, God's grace on full display through the weakness of mankind. Forgiveness transformed David. It changed him.
20 years of heartache and lament and grief and agony that are recorded in the psalm over and over, all the uncertainty, all the hardship, and he didn't ever see it come to a full conclusion, Saul getting it right with him. I'm sorry, David, for all these years. Will you forgive me, David? It was wrong. I was wrong before God. I was wrong with you. I was wrong to all your men. I want to do everything I can to make it right, David. That day never came. Instead, some wanderer came in and said, yeah, I killed him for you. And David's response was not, it was more this. How dare you touch the Lord's anointed? How can a man who's gone through such ills at the hands of someone else have that kind of heart? The power of forgiveness. Now, my friends, tonight, I would want us to recognize our God as the supreme example and enabler of forgiveness. So let's rejoice tonight to be forgiven people, if you are. But then, don't stop there. Let the enabler of forgiveness for your eternity enable you and me to forgive those who have hurt us or wronged us, present or past. And let him, even with our struggles and the difficulties of it, be changed. It can transform your motives. It can transform your choices. And you can actually find yourself viewing them and valuing God's work in and through them the way he's called you to. So let's do this. Let's take a time tonight. We're going to have our heads bowed. And I want to give you the opportunity as a child of God to reflect upon the issue of forgiveness in your own life with God and your forgiveness with those in your life that you've lived alongside of, who have hurt you or betrayed you. And I want us to ask ourselves, with the help of the Spirit, to have something encouraged, challenged, changed, or revealed. And then this week, let's be a conduit of forgiveness to that person. If it means a phone call even, or if it just means a change of our attitude, let's do that. I'm going to pray. Let's take some time after that to reflect. Father, help me, your needy child, the recipient of your abundant forgiveness and grace, to even in the middle of the struggle of hardship or heartache that's attached to someone's decisions, to be drawn to, like a magnet, your example and enablement of forgiveness. I pray for my brothers and sisters in the room. I don't know their hearts. I don't know all their situations. I couldn't possibly know those things because I'm not you, and I'm thankful. I pray you'd help them if there's something fresh, or I don't want to, nor did would I ever mean to create more heartache for them. But I do know if it's fresh, then they're here for a reason, online or in person. But God, it seems often with forgiveness, it's not fresh. It just feels fresh, but it's old. We haven't let you transform us. Help us take steps tonight with your grace and be changed. But we ask this not for our glory, but for yours. In the name of Jesus, our Savior. Amen.